Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Broadway Breakdown. I am your, basically your host these days, Matt Koplik, and joining me for a return to the stage is the lovely Prescott Seymour, also known as Sutton Lee Seymour, probably how we're going to list
probably
him on,
yeah.
On
this, yeah. Hi.
Hi.
I wish your listeners could have seen the immense facial expression you just gave to get into, hi everybody, like the eyes were wide, the jaw was unlocked, unhinged, and ready for a cock in your mouth.
You know what's really awful is that my grandmother has decided she wants to listen to this podcast, so when she eventually gets to this episode,
it's gonna be great. Hi grandma.
Hi nanny. That's become like a running joke on this pod, is that no one can see my face when we do it.
Right.
So they're really missing a great deal. We should start recording our recordings of it so people can see what I do, because I do a lot of action.
You
this.
Do. Imagine Kermit going, yay! And that's pretty much Matt Koplik's face.
I am very emotive.
Yes. But it shines through listening to it.
That's all that I care about.
Exactly.
That and love. Of blowjobs.
Oh.
Anywho.
Again, hello, Grandma.
Hello, Grandma. Hello, Nanny. How are you?
I'm doing well.
Yeah, you look well.
Oh, go on.
Yeah, well, I know that you just had a very nice workout, so you've got that post-workout shine.
I did. My endorphins are going crazy, so I'm feeling awake, I'm feeling alive, I'm invigorated.
You feel healthy and Jane Fondaful.
I do. Ooh, Jane Fondaful. That's a good verb.
It's a Howard Ashman rhyme on smile.
Ah, and you are obsessed with smile.
I am. It's not Broadway Breakdown if we don't mention bottoming, and I don't mention smile or carousel.
Have you done an obsessed on smile?
No, because no one's interviewed me for that yet.
Well, maybe you should work on that.
Yeah, I'll grab somebody. I'll have you come back, and you can interview me about my obsession on smile.
All the questions.
All the questions. For example, why?
Why not, is what I say.
Absolutely. Well, so I told you before we started recording, I had my audition for the Gay Men's Health Choir.
Yes, how'd it go?
Very well. And, of course, I sang Disneyland from Smile.
Of course you did.
Of course I did, because why wouldn't I? But, like, you know that you're in a room of people who get you when they say, oh, what are you going to sing? And I say, Disneyland. And 3 out of the 5 men shout, I love Smile.
Oh,
I didn't even say Smile. They just go, I love Smile.
That's when you know you're in the right place.
Mm-hmm.
You're with your people.
And then the monitor outside, who is a lovely gentleman, probably in his early 60s, said, thank you for singing that song, getting your Jody Benson on.
I was just going to say, back in the days when I worked for Disney Cruise Line on the transatlantic cruises, Jody Benson came and did a concert. And she sang Disneyland on the Disney cruise ship. And what's amazing to me is nobody in the audience knew what the hell that song was.
No.
And so, like, hearing it for the first time, it was just an energetic revelation to these people. And here is me, Mr. Homosexual, and, you know, Ro K, like, yas, queen!
Yas!
Jody Benson!
I mean, it's a great song. I love that score in general, but that song has become well-known for a reason.
Oh, yeah.
Have you seen the video of her doing it at the Hollywood Bowl?
I have not.
I mean, she's older, and so it's a little lower, but the fun thing about it, so it's at the Little Mermaid at the Hollywood Bowl live. So,
oh, the one with Sarah and Rebel Wilson. Wilson.
Yes, that whole one. No, who can anymore? Yes, that one. And they had Jody come out at the end.
Of course.
And she talked about, like, her journey with Little Mermaid and how that came from Howard Ashman. And she met Howard Ashman doing Smile.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a couple of gays in the audience. She's like, woo, Smile. And she goes, and I had a song, and it was, like, the big song on the show, and I sing it all the time, and I'm so excited to do it now. And some gay in Hollywood Bowl shouts, sing it, Jody!
Oh, my God.
And she shouts back, don't you know I will, baby?
She's a sassy woman.
I do love. She and Kristen Chenoweth are very similar in the sense that they love Jesus, but they are still here for the gays.
Yeah.
And, which I think shows
you,
like,
you can totally do both.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not a religious person. I don't care for religion at all, but I'm here for what gets you out of bed and makes you a good person and a loving person.
Right.
And in the case of Jodie Benson and Kristen Chenoweth, they can love Jesus and be like, gay men and
totally.
Women are allowed to be around.
I think that's admirable.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a nice little middle area.
So that's going to be just a preview of your upcoming Obsessed.
Yes.
On Smile.
Yes, you guys have that to look forward to when Prescott comes back on.
And
to
interviews
interview.
You.
Yes, exactly. Turning the tables. We have our own little obsession today.
Yes.
We'll get to it in a minute, just because I want to keep teasing these fuckwads.
You call your audience fuckwads, and your mom just walked by. Hi!
Mom! Oh, God. She can't leave me alone.
You've said fuck and wad in front of your mother.
I've said worse.
Jesus.
I mean, this episode will be coming after the episode with Abby Goldfarb, I guess, where I openly announced that I watched Easter Parade with my mother for the first time recently.
Oh, man.
So, like, if ever anyone thought that I was both gay and had a weird friendship with my mother, there you go.
There was never a question, Matt.
Never a question in the world. But there's been some fun announcements in the Broadway world that I wanted to get your take on before we got into your obsession.
So many things. I took copious notes last night, scouring.
Why not both?
Playbill.com. So much is happening, even stuff that I was like, oh, I did not realize that was coming.
Yeah.
So what are you excited about?
Well, numero uno thing I'm most excited about this season is Caroline or fucking Change.
That's the biggest news right now from the London production, right?
With the same lead.
Yes, Sharon something. I forgot her last name.
Lewis?
It's a Watson or something like that. I'm seeing a W right now.
Sharon Wilkes? No,
it's her Broadway debut.
It is. Because she's a London lady.
What's funny about Caroline or Change is I didn't get to see the original Broadway production, but people who have are obsessed with it, and are
that
so excited. So I'm excited to finally see it. I've only listened to the recording, so I'm excited to see it. And I know Dusty Ray Bottoms is excited to see it, and Paige Turner, because they both perform Lot's Wife.
Oh, do they?
Yes, which is wonderful and terrible at the same time.
Of course. I'm surprised neither of them have done any of Emmy Thibodeau's stuff, which is Anika Nani Rose.
Oh, God,
She's got some good stuff. You remember Fun Mama down at the parking lot alongside the A&W. I have a friend who took me to see a dress rehearsal of Caroline or Change at the Public Performing Arts High School this past year.
Wow.
Yeah, which I went in. I mean, it's PPAS. They're all very talented. It's like one of the two fame schools along with LaGuardia. So I knew they were talented, but I was like, 16-year-olds doing Caroline or Change? Okay.
Let's go.
Let's see. But it was so good.
Yeah?
And I was the only person in that audience who like knew that score.
Yeah.
So I was like bopping up and down to like random ass shit. just like when you did Wild Party and I was like a little 5-year-old. I was Kermit. No, I saw that original production and it was seeing that and Light in the Piazza within a 12-month period was very changing for me.
Yeah.
Yes. It definitely changed my perspective on theater. I went from being like a kid who loved everything to all of a sudden becoming an obnoxious little shit who's like, it's the structure isn't as strong as it could be.
Matt, you were always an obnoxious little shit. This just helped you enhance it.
16 feet below sea level, torn between the devil and the muddy brown sea. 16 soggy feet below the Gulf of Mexico.
You're most excited for too, Caroline or Change?
Well, no. I mean, I didn't realize that Take Me Out is making a revival next year.
Speaking of cock.
Yeah, hello. My favorite topic. with Jesse Tyler Ferguson.
Yeah.
Did not know that. Very excited about that. I'm also excited for Six to be coming to Broadway.
Same. Have you listened to it at all?
I have not.
Neither have I.
I've heard snippets. We do play some of it at Broadway Mondays at Hardware Bar every Monday night, 7 p.m. to 2 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
We do play, you know, our VJ plays a couple clips from it, and I've enjoyed it. It has this sound. It's kind of like, for those of you that don't know what Six is a rock concert version of the Six Wives of Henry VIII.
Yes.
So it's like Altar Boys, but less Jesus, more dead queens.
It's Altar Boys meets, I was going to say Man for All Seasons, which is about, which is in the time of Henry VIII, but not a lot of people know that play. No. Wolf Hall, I guess?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But like,
meets the Tudors.
But it's a concert. But it's been touring. It was in Chicago. I think it's in Boston.
Yeah, it's in Boston now.
And it's because everybody's raving about it. So I'm excited for it. I'm glad I don't have to travel to Chicago or Boston to see it because it's coming to me.
It is. I'm very excited for it too. I Anne Boleyn is like one of the most interesting people in history to me, mm-hmm. just because of the things that she got Henry VIII to do for her that changed the landscape of Europe. And she's also the mother of Elizabeth I. So, mm-hmm. you know, important woman. I tried really hard not to listen to the music. I have heard her song. Her song was played for me and I like it a lot. And I watched their Olivier performance because it did originate in London. And it was good. I wasn't as wildly impressed by it, but the word of mouth on the show is so fantastic.
It's so hot.
Yeah, that I'm
so hot.
It's so hot right now. Hansel, so hot right now. No, I'm very excited for it. And I think part of it is seeing it live.
And it's going to be one of my favorite Broadway theaters, the Brooks Atkinson Theater.
Mm-hmm.
I love that theater.
One of two theaters named after a theater critic.
Right?
Which
and the Walter Kerr.
Mm-hmm, I find that very interesting. It's like a weird abusive relationship Broadway has.
Right?
But theater critics.
Could you imagine one day the Ben Brantley Theater?
Oh, God. Mm. The only thing worse would be the Charles Isherwood Theater.
Ooh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Moving
right along. Next thing you're excited about?
There is... Oh, I'm... You know, people are a little hot and cold about the upcoming revival of West Side Story.
Mm-hmm.
Like you.
Like me.
But I'm excited based on the fact that the director, Ivan Van Hove, he's got such a reputation.
Yeah.
And speaking of Ben Brantley, Ben Brantley called him a maximist minimalist.
Yeah.
And this is his philosophy on theater, taking, an ultra modern minimalist shot through, theater with an expressionist theatricality. So basically, I don't know. I'm just intrigued that we're not going to see the Jerome Robbins choreography.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's going to be a little stripped down. I freaking love West Side Story, so they can revive it over and over and over again. I will still love it. I love the music. I am excited to see the new choreography.
Mm-hmm.
I'm excited. Oh, what's his name? Isaiah Powell? Isaac Powell is playing Tony, and mm-hmm. I loved him in Once on This Island.
As did I.
So I'm excited for that. Just give me West Side Story all over my face.
I love West Side Story as well. There's a lot of talent involved at the show that I am excited to see. There is the gentleman who's playing Bernardo. I don't remember how to pronounce his name, but he was Jigger in the last Carousel revival.
Mm-hmm.
I am not pleased about him being in the show.
Okay.
Partly because I thought he was terrible in Carousel, but also because he was involved with that whole scandal with New York City Ballet with he was one of the three men in the company as well as a patron who shared photos and videos of other women in the company and made very derogatory comments, and these photos and videos were taken without the girls' permissions, or they were taken and not, you know, allowed to, and they weren't given permission to share them, obviously.
Of course, yeah.
So I don't find him a very great person, and if he were an exceptionally talented person, or if I loved him in Carousel, I would be a little more conflicted, but I'm not as conflicted.
Well, good news.
He
West Side Story, you get to see him die.
I do get to see him get stabbed.
Spoiler
to
alert,
death.
If you've never seen West Side Story, and if you've never seen West Side Story, what rock have you been living under, and how are you listening to this podcast?
Exactly. I also don't love... I've always called him Ivo Van Hove. That could be 100% incorrect, the director.
I'm not sure how to correct, but like, his name is Ivo, but I think that's neat.
Ivo, Ivo, yes. I'm sure if you asked him, he'd just be like, yes.
Right.
He wouldn't be like, my name is my name. I have not liked anything that he's done.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I loved The Crucible.
See, I did like The Crucible because...
He's directed The Crucible. He just directed this recent production of Network on Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
So he did
Lazarus at New York Theater Workshop, and he did View from the Bridge.
Yeah.
And I saw View from the Bridge, and I was severely underwhelmed because I'd heard so many great things
really?
About it. Yeah.
He has a view. He has a perspective, and I
find it refreshing.
He
has a view from the bridge.
I don't get it.
Yeah. No, I find his stuff rather like emotionally sterile, if that makes sense. Like I've always found it to be technically impressive. I've never felt anything other than usually confusion from his stuff. I saw Lazarus, which was like batshit.
Yeah.
And from there, because after that, then I saw Crucible, and I liked Crucible, because at that point I was like, what are you going to do? Just throw it at me.
Right.
So, like, there was a wolf on the stage. Girls were levitating, and it was in a classroom, and blah. So I was just like, yeah, great, fun, love
I'm
it.
I'm just excited to see what they're going to do with it, because we're getting so much West Side Story coming up with the film coming out, and this revival, and I feel like there's West Side Story everywhere.
Yeah, they just released footage of a production happening in Japan, I think, that's in the round or something like
Fun.
That. Yeah. I love West Side, and I am not a purist. I think, like I say, you know, go for new choreography, go for a new interpretation.
I think that's what I'm most excited about, that they are actually breaking, for lack of a better term, breaking the chains of Jerome Robbins' vision, that we're going to get to see a new interpretation of it, which I think is so exciting. And not to poo-poo the Jerome Robbins, you know, history.
Yeah, that's iconic for a reason.
Exactly. But I'm just excited for something new.
Absolutely. I mean, I did not care for the last Fiddler revival, but the choreography, which was not Jerome Robbins, but 100% new, the choreography I thought was the best thing about it.
Right.
Yeah, so I'm all for it.
Great.
Yeah.
Exciting.
Yeah. Exciting.
Billy, I beg to differ with you.
How do you mean?
You're the top.
Yeah.
You're an arrow collar. You're the top.
Let's jump into Suddenly Seymour's obsession.
Well, that's another story. Never mind. Anyway. Transitions.
Transitions. What is your obsession for this episode?
For my obsession this episode, we are going to talk about my favorite musical, my favorite year. Just kidding.
After Patrick Sulkin's episode came out, Prescott texted me. He was like, I'm feeling very attacked. I love my favorite year. I did my favorite year.
I love my favorite year. It was my senior high school musical.
I didn't know that people did it.
We did it. It was great. It was a lot of fun. It is a fun show to be in. I don't know how the audience liked it, but we had a great time. But we're not talking about my favorite year.
We are not.
We are talking about Into the Woods.
Yes, we are. Which is another show where sometimes the cast has more fun than the audience.
This is true.
But
it depends on the concept.
Depends on the
show.
Concept. Depends on the level of production. Sometimes when you see a high school do it, the cast has more fun than the audience.
Yes. If you want a really good, a good fun time, just go watch one of those videos of the Boom Crunch streaming, just constant, one after the next. You see high school productions, you see professional productions, and not just the, sometimes ear-piercing Boom Crunches at the end of The Last Midnight, but then just watching a poor teenage girl with a cape trying to cover her face and trying to run off stage because she's quote-unquote disappearing.
Oh, no.
I know, but it's sweet. It just goes, good for you.
Yes. And the good news about this episode is that everyone's familiar with Into the Woods.
I would like to think so.
Yeah.
I think Into the Woods, in our generation specifically, it was kind of our West Side Story, and the Music Man. It kind of changed our view on theater.
Absolutely.
For me, I was maybe 5 or 6 years old when the PBS production came out, and my dad recorded it on the VHS tapes, and he saw it on Broadway. He knew I loved the Phantom of the Opera recording and Les Mis recording, and he thought this would be fun, and it's fairy tales. And it came out in March of 1991, and March of 1991 was the month I decided this is what I want to do with my life. I want to pursue theater. I want to dive into the layers of text and lyrics. I want to understand everything that is musical theater because of Into the Woods, because of this production. And I think a lot of people in our generation of actors have a similar feeling towards Into the Woods.
Absolutely.
Don't you think?
Yeah. I mean, I know that in March of 1991, that was my epiphany too. Granted, I was turning one, but still.
I'm old, okay.
I mean, no, that VHS of Into the Woods, of the original Broadway production of Into the Woods, is it's historic. It's very important.
Absolutely.
It's definitely, every generation has that thing.
Yes.
That made that generation of actors and writers and designers want to pursue it. And I think it's not hyperbole to say that Into the Woods, that production, that recording, did that for us. You know, every decade or so, there's something that kind of comes along, and, you know, a few years later,
rented the same thing for slightly younger than us. Not that much younger, just like a few years younger. And then there's some overlap there. And then Hamilton and Hairspray.
Yeah.
But yeah, like...
The thing about Into the Woods at that time... So Hamilton and Rent, those are... You're talking about, like, those are major pop culture phenomenons.
Like, the country knows it.
Exactly. Into the Woods, people know it, but at that time, it was being kind of buried by The Phantom of the Opera and Les Mis. But still beat... Phantom of the Opera for best score and best book.
Yes.
And best actress in a musical. Hello, Joanna Gleason.
Hello, Joanna Gleason.
So it has... Into the Woods has a place in our theatrical hearts. I think everyone in the community knows and loves Into the Woods and knows the potential that any production could have. And that's why I think a lot of people want to do it. Whereas Phantom of the Opera at that time, and even today, it's still running today.
Yeah.
It's so... musically sweeping and mesmerizing and you know, it's literally the Phantom through the mirror saying, I am your angel, and stealing people away from Into the Woods. That's what I say.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, as with every obsession, we learn more about it and its history, how it was perceived at the time. And when you watch the 1988 Tony Awards, because it's on YouTube, the whole thing, Phantom very much was like the thing that year.
Every
Tony telecast, you can tell, like, what's the thing
there. You can feel the buzz in the end. I mean, and I found recently a bootleg on YouTube of the original Phantom of the Opera with Michael Crawford and Sarah Brightman, and watching just the prologue, and then
That audience goes crazy
when the chandelier leaves the stage and flies above them and goes up. The crowd goes crazy.
Absolutely.
So just to feel that kind of excitement, because at that time, spectacle on Broadway like that was not really seen or heard of.
No.
So of course there's going to be a great buzz about it.
Yeah.
Into the Woods does have, it's fairy tale, so of course there's going to be magic and transformations and witches disappearing in a cloud of smoke and all that, and magic beans and beanstalks. But somehow Phantom, because of a frickin' chandelier, mesmerized the country. Yeah.
There were the shows that the public decided were like the things, and then there were the shows that the theater community was like, but we still love this. So even though if you watch the Tony telecast of 1988, Phantom is clearly like the buzziest show. But there was still a love for Into the Woods
Into the Woods, like, gave it Phantom a run for its money.
Absolutely. It won the Drama Desk for Best Musical that
year. And the
Critics Circle Award. And it ran longer than a lot of... the longest running Sondheim show, I think, since Forum. Because it ran longer than The Company.
It had a solid 2 years on Broadway.
Yeah. And the reviews were, like, kind of a little all over the place. The New York Times didn't care for it. But that's because by that point... Sondheim had already done Sweeney Todd and A Little Night Music. He had had
Sunday in the Park.
He had a major comeback with Sunday in the Park with George. And I think critics were really excited to see Into the Woods.
Right.
Because they were thinking, same collaborator, an amazing cast. Like, this is going to be super, like...
With a cast starring Bernadette Peters, like, it was kind of like, oh, this could be a win-win-win situation.
Yes.
And I think, had Phantom of the Opera waited one more season, I think Into the Woods could have been the hit musical that year.
Yeah, and this is not to undercut its success as it was. It was
very successful.
Yeah, and especially for a Sondheim musical. The fact that it returned its investment at all.
It is still his most produced show, regionally in high schools. Mm-hmm. It is his most produced show.
Yeah, but as with every Sondheim show, it opened and like it had its fans, it had its detractors, and it also got overshadowed by flashier, bigger stuff.
Well,
but it has lasted.
Yeah, it's lasted, and people still feel very... divisive about how Act 2 is treated, you know, because it follows the same structure as Sunday in the Park with George, where Act 1 is its own story and Act 2 is its own story, and it becomes one musical. And some people just responded very negatively to the darkness of Act 2, but it's so important.
It is important.
And we can talk about the themes.
Of course. I also became very obsessed with Into the Woods at a very young age. I did like a highlight version of the show, super illegal, when I was like 8 or 9 years old. I played Jack. I think it was literally like an 80-minute version, which was sort of the whole show. Basically, it was like we did the majority of Act 1 and then a highlights version of Act 2.
Right. Which is like the movie.
Sort of. Yeah, pretty much. I have a fondness for the movie. I don't think the movie's perfect, but I think for what they were trying to do, they did it as well as you could.
We, you know, they did a, I thought act one in the movie was wonderful, and then they just kind of sped through act two and they made some changes. I didn't agree with it, but that's another story. Never mind. Anyway, every time I say that, take a shot.
No, I do enjoy the movie. There are parts of the second half that you're right. They do speed through a little bit. I wish they would live a little more in the no one is alone section of it. I was a little, not annoyed. I was disappointed that they kind of plopped through it. Yeah. But I also will fight for the fact that I think that even though they weren't allowed to technically kill Rapunzel on screen, the attitude of the movie I felt was that she will go and die. The way they end her storyline in the movie is that, like, she's going off with a man who... They changed Rapunzel's prince's character.
Yeah.
So that he's less of a cat and more of a bumbling idiot. Yeah. And in the face of this really big danger, he can't protect her. And she goes off into, like, very dense mist with, like, ominous music playing. And I felt that was projecting, like, she will die very shortly after this moment, but she'd rather go and do that than stay with her mother.
I mean, the sentiment, it has the same sentiment. I don't know. I think, literally, once she rides off with her prince, her story is there, and that's up to your interpretation.
That's my interpretation.
That's fine. I until you see her being squashed by the giant, you know.
Yeah.
Unless you see a dead body... presume that the character is still alive.
Sure. That is fair. That has always just been my interpretation.
I think it just robbed Meryl Streep's we're getting into performances now, because it is so important for Rapunzel to be killed by the giantess, because then at that point the witch has literally lost everything. She's lost her home, she's lost her garden, she's lost her daughter, and now she's dead. And now people, when it gets to that last midnight moment where people are pointing things at her saying it's her fault, she loses her mind. And so, in my mind, Rapunzel running off into the mist with the prince, there is still hope that the witch could catch up with her one day, and I'm gonna find you. But you take away her stakes a little bit, and I think that
stakes are a little lower.
Yeah, the stakes are a little lower. Now, Meryl Streep is a goddess, as we all know, and her performance in Last Midnight was frightening and wonderful. But me being the obsessed freak that I am on Into the Woods just went, but did you really lose everything? You're just giving up. You're not even going to go to try to find Rapunzel. No, you're just going to get sucked in the ground. Okay, fine.
Okay, fine. No, I absolutely get that. And it's true. With Rapunzel, and it's more, not even that Rapunzel dies, but that Rapunzel gets killed right in front of her eyes.
Yeah.
So it's the last, first of all, it's the last thing tethering her to this world that she had any... stake in, but it's also the fact that Rapunzel's dying is partly her fault, in the sense that her treatment of her daughter, her overprotectiveness of her daughter, is what drove her daughter away.
Exactly.
And into death. The second act is absolutely important, and anyone who, even when I was a child, they would say, the second act's not important. And be like,
oh, but
it is. And it's hard sometimes to see that, because now that we all are aware of the show, a lot of productions try to really revel in the darkness of Act Two. And James Lapine said a very great thing about directing the show, which I think is very important, is in order for the two to cohabitate, you need to find the tragedy in Act One and the humor in Act Two.
Interesting.
Because Act One already has so much humor in it.
Oh, yeah.
But the stakes have to feel real for the humor to be alive. And in order for the tragedy in Act Two to be palatable, you do have to find the humor in a lot
you
of
do,
stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And there's nothing better than dark humor. I think any production needs to, any actor, any director, however you stage it, it really is borderline a Shakespearean piece. Act One is such a farce. People coming in and out.
Oh, yeah.
And instead of doors, you have woods.
Yeah. Slamming down trees.
Exactly. And the stakes have to be high. And it's funny because the stakes are high. They're ridiculous because they're literally trying to find a cow as white as milk, a cape as red as blood, a hair as yellow as corn, and slippers pure as gold. That's ridiculous. But if you play it almost like a Shakespearean play, which I feel like they do in the original Broadway production, in that PBS production, it works so well because it's not melodrama, but it's heightened.
Yes.
And so you can find the sincerity in the heightened state in the world that you live in, which is why I think the comedy works so well. And even going to Act Two, you're still able to find humor. For instance, when Jack's mother gets killed by the steward, and he has snarky lines here and there, and one-liners, one left and right. They're dark, but they're still kind of funny.
Oh, yeah.
You know? Oh, like, I don't make policy, I just carry it out. Mm-hmm. The stakes are so high and people are dying, and that's what you're going to say? It works. It's funny. Yeah.
It's what I love about... So, okay. There is also a comment that the original production is so iconic that so many interpretations are hard to...
It
come
is.
Up with stuff. And it is.
Yes.
But I think the problem is that people... In theater, I find that a lot of people want to make sure that their mark is made.
Yes.
And people's initial instincts are to go 100% in the opposite direction of what the original was to make said mark.
And I think that's respectable.
Sure. It's a little... impulsive. Not, that's not the right word. But like reactive or
you don't want to be, as an artist, as an actor, as a director, you do not want to be seen as a copycat. You
sure.
want to be able to interpret a piece of material with your own vision.
Yes. But I also find, especially with something like Into the Woods, looking at the original, you can look at it and go, okay, what made this work?
Right.
And something that I think made the original work so well was the rhythm of that production.
It was almost like a sitcom.
Yeah. It was because you have these... Shakespearean tragedy moments followed by a moment of dropped in New York sarcasm.
Like, absolutely.
One of my favorite moments in the original production that nobody has ever done since, or at least not nearly as well, is in Act One. The first time that the baker's wife, Joanna Gleason, and Cinderella Kim Crosby meet.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this big heightened moment. You know, the baker's wife has the cow. She and her husband are trying to lift this curse. And they already, James Lapine already said that, like, the way he directed Chip Zine and Joanna Gleason was like they were a modern New York couple dropped into these giant fairy tales.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's how they sort of reacted to things. So everybody else had these big, you know, Shakespearean moments, and they were like, meh. but already you have these heightened things, and you have Bernadette Peters as witch running around being a crazy person, and Kim Crosby runs on stage, and she's being chased by the prince and his steward. It's big,
falling over in a ball gown.
But falling over, these big theatrical moments. She comes out breathless, and she says to the baker's wife, oh, thank you so much, and Joanna Gleason already has her, oh, I've never lied to royalty before.
Mm-hmm.
Perfect line reading, but...
Because her dry tones are just comedic gold.
Gold. But so she and Kim Crosby talk. She goes, if a prince were looking for me, I certainly wouldn't hide. And Kim Crosby says, well, what brings you here?
Oh, thank you. If a prince were looking for me, I certainly wouldn't hide. Well, what brings you here? And with a cow?
Oh... Well, my husband is in the woods somewhere. He's undoing a spell.
Oh, yeah.
Ooh.
Like, it's so natural and organic, and it's very modern.
Exactly.
And it's this little bit of modernism in this scene of theatricality.
It's honest. It's honest.
It's absolutely honest. And no one has done it really...
Nobody
or
can
as well.
Replicate that.
Yes.
No.
I mean,
or
it's
even the moment when Joanna Gleason says, compare this to your court. Where did you find this?
I pulled it from a lady in a tower.
Like, nobody can replicate that. Sorry, Sutton Foster, you were wonderful as the baker's wife, but nobody can do that like Joanna Gleason.
Yeah.
And that's the reason why she won the Tony Award for Best Actress.
Sorry, Patti LuPone.
But
Patti does say, she's like, Joanna Gleason absolutely deserved the Tony for featured actress. And I say, no.
Bitch.
Well, and it's a testament to her performance that it feels like a leading performance.
I mean, it is.
It is. And The Baker's Wife truly is the female lead of
that
show.
Well, this is how nerdy I am. Okay. Like, I have a lot of free time sometimes. And so I've met, like, Joanna Gleason is on stage. It's a 2.5-hour musical, and she is on stage for 1 hour and 15 minutes. Yes, I counted the minutes that she is on stage. I've even counted the minutes that Bernadette Peters is on stage, and it is 41 minutes on stage. So, if you're going to say featured actress or leading actress, Joanna Gleason has the longest stage time compared to Bernadette Peters and Kim Crosby. Now, the person who has the most stage time is, of course, the baker, who is on stage for like all of like 1 hour and 35 minutes.
Yeah, a lot of
time. And his performance, Chip Zine, I can never remember how to pronounce
it. I think it's Zine.
Yeah.
Chip Zine.
His performance is, honestly, I think it's underappreciated.
Yeah.
I think some people do get annoyed by his performance, but I just think he's just playing his honesty. And I think maybe, I thought it was wonderful.
I absolutely understand. His performance was the longest for me to warm up to. All the times that I've watched it.
Yeah.
I love it now.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't, sometimes I wonder with things like that, like, is it that I'm just used to it now? I don't know. But,
That's the thing, watching it. I mean, I watch Into the Woods maybe 3 times a year. I always come back to it because I just love it. And I always still find little nuances that they kind of, that I've never caught before. Like those moments with Kim Crosby and Joanna Gleason.
That moment is just iconic. It's Chip Zion's, the Baker, I would actually argue is perhaps, so the Baker and the Baker's Wife, I think, are the two hardest roles to play in the show for different reasons.
Because it's their fairy tale.
It's their fairy tale. Baker's Wife is the hardest female role because Joanna Gleason is so iconic. It is so tethered to her. It's like Ellen Green as Audrey. It's yes. like Barbara Streisand as Fanny Bryce. They've put their mark on it so definitely, yeah. and it's tailored to their talents that lines just don't work as well if you don't do it the way they did it. Right. But you also want to do your own thing, so that's hard to do. The Baker is hard because he is so passive for so much of the show.
Yeah.
And in Act Two, when shit hits the fan,
he doesn't make any choices on his own until his wife is dead.
Exactly. And so that's hard to make audiences care about you.
True.
And I think speaking of the movie, I actually think James Corden did a really lovely job of doing
yeah.
that.
He was wonderful.
He's probably my favorite. He and Chip Zion are now probably tied for my favorite Bakers.
Yeah, I don't think I've seen a Baker that I've fallen fully in love with.
Yes.
Sorry, Dennis O'Hare.
I love Dennis O'Hare. He was not good in that revival. Boop. Part of that was, I think, the direction. Part of that was, I think, he felt just so lost that he kind of gave up.
I mean, it is a heavy role.
It is a heavy role, and that production did not do any favors to the heaviness.
I mean, it was, well, we can talk about that production. We can talk. I've got so many productions I want to talk about, too.
I texted my friend during, we're talking about the Central Park production that was a transfer of the
Open Air Theater.
Yeah, at Regent's Park. I saw it first in Central Park, and I was like, this is what they were freaking out about? And then I watched the video of the Regent's Park cast, and I was like, oh, makes a world of difference.
It really, really does.
And the cast here was exceptionally talented.
Very good.
And I'm not shading any. Everyone in it is amazing. Amy Adams, Dennis O'Hare, Donna Murphy.
I think Josh Lehman stole the show as the steward. That's just my personal opinion.
He was very good. And Sarah Stiles as Little Red.
Oh my God.
Like, and Gideon Glick as Jack. Like, it was the most phenomenally talented cast.
A really great cast.
Should, on paper, have blown the trees out of Central Park. And somehow I just felt it didn't. Well,
see, no, that's interesting because I saw it twice. Mm-hmm. I saw the first preview and they were figuring it out. It was rough. And then I came back towards the end of their run and they had figured it out and it was working and it was just fantastic. I've never seen an audience freak out over The Last Midnight like that. Mm. Again, I think Josh Lehman's performance was so wonderful and hysterical, taking a thankless role and making it a something role. Mm-hmm. They made some changes with Amy Adams's performance, which was fantastic, I thought. I want to talk with Sarah Stiles' performance as Little Red. Now, mm-hmm. there's someone who took a role that has been highly established by Danielle Ferland mm-hmm. as the original, and she took it and she made it her own, especially because the London production of the Open Air Theater, Little Red Riding Hood, was played by a woman who was bigger, and she was hilarious. Mm-hmm. But Sarah Stiles, who is petite, she kind of made it her own.
Yeah, she was a much fiery Little Red.
She was a little fiery. She had a little ADD. She had mm-hmm. a little, you know, biker helmet on the whole time. She completely made it her own.
Absolutely.
And that's hard to do. And she did it.
When he said, "Come in," with that sickening grin, how could I know what was in store? Once his teeth were bare, though I really got scared. Well, excited and scared, but he drew me close and he swallowed...
The original Into the Woods in London, I mean, the West End and Broadway has had a long history of transfers. You know, it used to be that Broadway shows transferred to London in their exact productions.
This was an original production.
Yes, Into the Woods opened in New York in November or December of 87 and then didn't make it to London until 1990.
Right.
A brand new production.
Yes.
And the design for the Broadway, for the West End production was, the woods basically were like, it looked like a giant dining room where the woods were the woods were like wallpaper designs of trees. But like, there were trick doors that you would come out of.
You're almost like in an attic, too.
Exactly.
There's like a giant window in the background.
Window, and there's a cuckoo clock.
Yes.
And chairs and things like that. the idea was almost like a dining room from a child's perspective, so things were bigger than they would be normally. And I never saw it, but there is that video that I have seen of Last Midnight, and I've read pieces about it. Apparently, when they were doing the first One Midnight Gone, and they go right into Giants in the Sky. There are giants in the sky. A transition they did was they had a chair in the middle of the stage, and Jack jumps onto the chair, and they go, into the woods, then out of the woods, and home before, boom. And on that bum, Jack jumps onto the chair, the lights go out, and there's a spot on him, and it's like stars everywhere. So it's like he's in the sky.
Awesome.
It's gorgeous. I'm getting chills thinking about it, even though I never saw it.
There are a couple more clips on YouTube of the original London production.
Yeah.
My favorite about that is the actress who played the baker's wife is none other than Imelda Staunton.
Dolores Umbridge.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
And probably the most frightening Mama Rose I've ever seen on screen.
Did you see that?
I watched it.
She's frightening.
In a good way. Like, you thought Patti LuPone was a monster theater mama? Oh, no.
Have you ever wondered what Gollum was like as Mama Rose? I've got news for you, kids. Imelda Staunton, Mama Rose.
You're a star. I pray you, precious.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
I mean, I wish I'd seen it live, because I was not as enamored with it on screen as people were live, and I was told by many people, like, you had to see it live. And watching it, I was like,
course.
I feel like this is very effective in the theater.
Everything's going to be better live. I always say, if I could go back in time to see a Broadway production, I know this is terrible, but I probably would go see the original Broadway production of Into the Woods, because it's my favorite.
Yeah. I would love to have seen the original Broadway production live as well. Just to see it in original incarnation in front of me.
Right.
What is your favorite moment in Into the Woods? What is your favorite moment in the woods?
It's still... Ooh, I'm getting chills thinking about it right now. There's still moments that make me tear up.
Mm-hmm.
Joanna Gleason singing Moments in the Woods.
Yes.
And when she sings, let the moment go, don't forget it for a moment though. Like, right? It's just... It still makes me just take a sigh of like, you're right. And it... And of course, everything from like No More to No One Is Alone, it just makes me bawl. But my favorite moment.
You can talk to birds.
It's just so funny.
It is. And talk about that. I mean, there's a reason why that cast is iconic.
Just yeah.
Danielle Furlan's line delivery of You Can Talk to Birds.
So dry.
Oh my God.
So good.
And just to watch that audience lose themselves is... And the reason it works is because that entire scene leading up to it, just like, the stage is like a wasteland and everyone is covered in dirt and it's all hope is lost. And we've already gotten accustomed to the fact that Cinderella can talk to birds. And we see Kim Crosby just play her talking to the birds,
like,
so straight.
We've accepted all these rules of this world. Cinderella can...
Things happen.
And here, at the final moment, you can talk to birds. It's so... good writing, James Lapine.
He writes some good stuff. He's got a new musical coming out, folks, that
looks...
that's
right.
That, I mean... I was reading about it, I'm like, this looks fucking crazy. But, like, you read the plot synopsis of Into the Woods and Sunday in the Park with George, and you're like, this is fucking crazy.
To be in the mind of James Lapine.
I know, right? God, I hope that this is another Into the Woods in terms of, like, it shouldn't work, and yet it does.
I really think Into the Woods kind of... And I think we have James Lapine to thank for this. Into the Woods kind of set up a bunch of fractured fairy tales and different ways
absolutely.
To tell stories, to look at things from a different perspective. I mean, look at Frozen, look at Tangled,
mm-hmm.
look at without Into the Woods, I don't know if we would have Wicked,
mm-hmm.
you know, looking at fairy tales or famous stories from a different angle.
Oh, yeah. People give that a lot to Shrek, and I'm like...
There would be no Shrek without Into the Woods.
Absolutely. Into the Woods really... I mean, I have not researched everything about the history and presentation of fairy tales. Maybe there's some random dude in Wisconsin who did it in 1970 for five children or something.
It's
like,
possible.
It's, things happen.
Very,
but,
very possible. I can just quote it for days. Sorry.
Yes, if you don't know what Prescott was just doing, that was Bernadette Peters. Giant. Possible.
Very, very possible.
A giant. Maybe we should tell someone.
Who are you gonna tell?
So big.
So big.
It's also funny when you read the script and then watch the Broadway cast, like the jokes they find and things that aren't necessarily jokes.
Right.
So like the that whole line where, so at the beginning of Act Two, when the giant that Jack killed, his wife comes back to like cause havoc, wreak havoc, sorry. And the baker, the baker's wife and the witch discuss like what could cause this destruction in our village. And first, bear. No, it's a bear, not a bear. It's not a dragon, not a manticore. And then they go, giant, very, very possible. And then the witch is describing the danger of a giant. In the script, it reads as, a giant is like us, only bigger. Much, much bigger. So big that we are that we are an expendable bug beneath its foot.
And it's just Bernadette Peters being pure Bernadette Peters.
And she goes, much, much bigger.
So big.
Because that's
anything
actually,
your listeners know they've seen Into the Woods.
They have to have. But like, and you read the script, it's, the line is actually so big that we are an expendable bug beneath its foot. But she makes it two sentences. So big. And that's a joke.
Right.
Like, normally reading it, we go, much, much bigger. So big that we are. And it's like, she goes, there's a joke in there. So she goes, so big.
I mean, she's a funny lady.
We forget how fucking funny she is.
Hello, somebody.
I love the, in Act One with the mysterious man, she scares him and he goes, She goes, what are you doing?
Oh my God, so good.
What are you doing?
And Tom Aldridge is the narrator and mysterious man.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I think underappreciated. His performance is wonderful.
It was a full day of eating for both. I also love Daniel Furlan's, oh dear, how uneasy I feel.
So good.
So good.
They were constantly disillusioned, but they never lost their nerve. And they reached the right conclusions.
And we got what we deserve. Not a sigh and not a sorrow. Tenderness and laughter. Joy today and bliss tomorrow and forever after.
So what do you think makes a successful production of Into the Woods?
You have to have smart actors.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. You can't... you have to... There's so... Yeah. Oh, golly. It's casting.
Mm-hmm.
It can't... What makes a good production? You have to have a good director who comes in prepared. Because
mm-hmm.
you have to be able to stage something specifically. And you have to have smart actors who have had, who experienced life. Because Into the Woods deals so much with loss. And the reason why Stephen Sondheim and James Lapine wrote this show is basically relationships with parents and children.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we have songs like No One Is Alone and Children Will Listen. And Sondheim, having had a very conflicted relationship with his own mother,
mm-hmm.
This was kind of his way of kind of expressing that and dealing with his emotions with it.
Yeah.
I didn't read up on why James Lapine wanted to write this show, but to me, the father's, parents and children's relationship has always struck a chord with me.
Mm.
I think that's another reason why I love this show so much, is because I come from a broken family. I'm the youngest of eight, but technically an only child.
Oh, okay.
So I... You know, and my parents divorced when I was like 2 years old. And so I was going back and forth from house to house to house. My siblings, who were much older than me, all half siblings, all step siblings, in and out. And so I think this show kind of taught me a lot about how to cope with loss and the suddenness of death, because nobody in Act Two, nobody is ready to see Rapunzel, an established fairy tale character that we all know and love. No one is prepared to see her get killed. Mm-hmm. Here's Jack's mother. No one is prepared for her to die because she's such a fun, loving character, and now she's dead.
Yeah.
And so, as a 5-year-old, 6-year-old watching the show, that was a lot for me to start coping with the ideas of mortality. So, back to the question. It's important for an actor to really know yourself, know your emotions. I think an actor who has experienced a little bit of loss in their own life,
mm-hmm.
so they can bring that to the stage. Because when you're watching the baker sing No More, you can't just have a senior from college who hasn't necessarily experienced that. You have to, you don't know what those lyrics mean until you kind of lived them. And I think that speaks a lot about Sondheim's lyrics and his music.
Absolutely.
Because they come from such a sense of truth in his own life. Getting back to his relationship with his
parents.
Sorry, that was a bit of a tirade.
No,
but
that I gave you the floor for that.
Yeah.
And this is your obsession. No, you're absolutely... Sondheim had a very complicated relationship with his mother. And the more I think about it, the more I realize that the Rapunzel witch storyline does mirror that.
Yes.
Sondheim also comes from a broken home. His parents divorced when he was very young. His mother never remarried, as far as I know, but his father did, and like kind of had a whole new life, and mm-hmm. which is why he looked at Oscar Hammerstein as like a second father, because mm-hmm. he was more of a father to him than his real father. And his mother was just sort of this overbearing, narcissistic, and very resentful woman. It was almost like she resented him for existing, but yet his existence justified her existence. So it was like, I need you to know that I think nothing of you, but don't you dare leave my side.
Exactly. And it gets to that scene where the witch asks Rapunzel, what's the matter? Oh, nothing. Has that monologue, and then I truly believe that in this moment, when the witch says, I was just trying to be a good mother, I believe Sondheim could, you know, Sondheim's mom could have said something like that to her.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, to him. To him, excuse me.
Pamela
Winslow.
Winslow, yes. God, what a phenomenal Rapunzel she was.
Yes.
Oh my God. And she's such a great scene partner for Bernadette all the time. Rapunzel basically acts as a scene partner for the witch.
Exactly. That role, again, kind of a thankless role. You got a couple nice scenes, mm-hmm. but you are really there to feed the actress playing the witch.
Yes. But the witch is only effective if we buy into her relationship with Rapunzel.
If you buy the pain that Rapunzel is feeling, and mm-hmm. the minute, you know, before Stay With Me, you can see the fear in her eyes. You can see, like, the conflicted, like, I love you, but I'm afraid of you, and I want to get away, but I want to be with you.
That Stockholm Syndrome is. Yeah,
she does such a good job with that.
Oh, my God. Their connection at the end of Stay With Me, when it's that little moment where Bernadette does the, like, little walking fingers to Rapunzel on the Stay a Child, and Rapunzel grabs the fingers like a little baby.
And kisses them.
And she has the tears in her eyes.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, it's a lovely moment.
Oh, it's breaking my heart right now.
Mine too. Chills.
Can I tell you? Oh, go finish your thought.
But then when Bernadette, at the end of it, goes crazy again, and you see the fear in Rapunzel. You see her go from, like, loving and caring and sad to fear all of a sudden. Rapunzel's a hard part to cast as well, because you do need a good soprano who can do those lovely, but you need a good actress too.
And so, fun fact, did you know that the role of Rapunzel, she was a replacement, but this was Marin Mazzie's Broadway debut?
I did know that.
And so, can I tell you a quick story about Marin Mazzie?
Yes. Before you do, there is a video of Marin Mazzie as Rapunzel.
I've seen it.
Yes.
Nancy Dussault. Dussault,
yes, is the witch, and it's Stay With Me, and you do see her play Rapunzel in it. It's lovely.
So, Marin Mazzie, I've taken a couple of, when she was with us, I got to take a couple of her classes. She came to my school, and we got to do some master classes with her, and she mm-hmm. tells this story. Rapunzel was her Broadway debut in the original production of Into the Woods, mm-hmm. and I don't know if it was her first night on or within the first week she was on, so she's playing Rapunzel, and she is the second cover to play the witch. Mm. Within the first week, Marin Mazzie has to go on as the witch in Into the Woods. And it's her first week on Broadway. And, like, if that's not a star turn right there, again, brilliant soprano, but you've got to be such a good actress. Mm-hmm. And Marin Mazzie was one of the best actresses we had in this generation.
She was a phenomenal actress.
Yes.
I do know the original production, because Pamela Winslow did understudy Cinderella.
I would have liked to have seen that.
Yeah, I know that usually Rapunzel does understudy Cinderella, because Rapunzel is a part. It's a good
featured role.
Yes, exactly. It's an established track.
Yes.
But usually to, like, cover costs, they, you know, don't want to, and, you know, Into the Woods, it's hard to have, like, a giant understudy cast for an ensemble. So usually there are people in the established cast that understudy other parts.
Right, like the stepsisters covered the baker's wife.
Mm-hmm, and Cinderella's stepmother understudies the witch, I believe, yeah.
I think also the original stepmother, I forget her name right now, but
Joy Franz.
Yes, you do.
I'm going hot.
She also covered the witch as well. She covered the witch and the baker's wife. There was a period where she played the baker's wife as well.
Yes, she did. And I know that both stepsisters, yes, they did understudy the baker's wife. In fact,
Kay McClelland played the role for a little while,
yes,
too.
Yes, as did the other one. I forget her name.
We always remember Kay McClelland, but the other
because
one.
City of Angel. That's why Kay McClelland.
Lauren
Mitchell, that's her name. I have a playbill where Lauren Mitchell is the baker's wife officially for, like, a solid 2 weeks. The turnover in that cast is weird with the first couple of months, because, like, Bernadette Peters famously only played the witch for, like, 4 months.
5 months.
5 months and then left. Right. But in those 5 months, like, there's some weird moments where, like, I guess Joanna Gleason had to go film something, somebody else had to go film something. So I've got like 4 playbills of the original Broadway production.
Oh, really? I hope they have one, you homo.
I'm a giant homo. But like, there's one with Bernadette and Lauren Mitchell's officially the baker's wife, and it's like the entire company, but then there's Felicia Rashad.
Betsy Joslin.
Mm-hmm.
Crazy. Oh, crazy. Have you seen the videos of her playing the witch?
Oh, yeah.
She batshit crazy girl.
Well, I mean, she's the craziest Joanna you've ever seen in Sweeney Todd.
I know. But the crazy works for the witch.
It does. Not so much for Joanna. But no. Sondheim likes her Joanna, but, you know, whatever. There you go. I know Maren Maisie, as Rapunzel, did understudy Cinderella, and she also understudied Little Red, which I think was very special for her because she was young enough to do it.
She was young. She was fresh out of school.
She was. I don't think Rapunzel usually understudies Little Red, but that's one of those things where, like, if you have a young enough Rapunzel, probably could.
Yeah.
And then her covering the witch, I think, was very special to her. I don't think Rapunzel's usually did that.
No. That just speaks volumes of the performer that Maren Maisie was.
Exactly.
And, like, you could see, even in that bootleg video that you've seen, I've seen, mm-hmm. you could see, oh, there's something special here.
Oh, yeah. She had a very special voice where she had that classical soprano, that beautiful mix, and, like a nice chesty belt. Yeah.
Oh.
And a very smart actress and a good comedic actress.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
To do Mother in Ragtime and Lily Vanessi in Kiss Me, Kate back-to-back shows you the kind of talent she was.
Right.
To do Aldonza in Man of La Mancha and then
go on to do her performance in Bullets Over Broadway playing
Helen Sinclair.
There it is, Helen Sinclair. Very Norma Desmond like.
Mm-hmm. She would have been
such a good Norma Desmond.
Oh, God, motherfucking damn it.
Now we need to do another Obsessed with Maren Maisie.
I ain't mad about it.
Let's talk about some of the replacements that played in Into the Woods.
Yes, please. Yes,
because it also gave us Jeff Blumenkrantz because mm-hmm. he understudied Jack and he got to go on.
Yes, he did.
A bunch. Did you know, and this is news to me, Douglas Sills was in the national tour.
I did know that. He was one of the princes,
was
he not?
He was Rapunzel's prince with Chuck Wagner as Cinderella's prince.
And he was the original Rapunzel's prince on Broadway.
Yes.
Yes.
Again, back to the understudying. He understudied Robert Westenberg as Cinderella's prince. Could you imagine just like the crazy tracking?
I was about to say, the switching around that happened. Imagine being like the stage manager on that show and like 2 people are out and it's like, okay, here right. we go. It's like a board, it's like a chess game.
But like, could you imagine? For those of you that don't know, so Robert Westenberg, the original Cinderella's prince, and Kim Crosby and the wolf, and Kim Crosby, the original Cinderella, they ended up married.
Mm-hmm.
And could you imagine? So like, and this is when their relationship started. So they're falling in love on stage and they're kissing and they're having a relationship outside the theater. And of course they're professionals. I'm sure it's no big deal, but imagine Robert Westenberg having to call out, and then Chuck Wagner's like, oh, now I got to kiss Chuck Wagner. And I hope that this doesn't make Robert feel jealous. I would love to ask Kim Crosby that question.
It's like, there was a brief week where I thought I might be falling in love with Chuck Wagner, but then Robert came back into the show.
No, and here we are.
Well, do you know that Victoria Mallory, the original Anne in the Little Night Music, and I know this because Vicky used to be my voice teacher for a while when she was still with us. Vicky, Victoria Mallory, was dating Len Carreyrou, the original Frederick in the Little Night Music, when the show was out of town and while they were on Broadway. And then they broke up pretty soon after they opened. And then she started dating the original Henrik, and they ended up getting married.
Oh, interesting.
So, literally,
and they had a Broadway baby.
Yeah, and they had a Broadway baby, Miss Ramona Mallory. But that was a case of life literally imitating art, where she was dating the Frederick. They ended things, then she went off with Henrik. She talks about it to this day. I keep talking about it like she's still here. But she told me about the night that she started dating Mark, who was the original Henrik. They were backstage waiting for their entrance because they had to come on after Send in the Clowns.
Mm-hmm.
And she would always watch the scene because Glynis Johns was just so incredible.
Right.
And then one night, like, Mark just came up next to her and held her hand. And she was like, and that's when I knew. And I went, motherfucking damn it. That's beautiful.
A fine romance.
Do you know who also was the original Snow White in Into the Woods, understudying Little Red and Cinderella?
Gene Kelly?
Yeah, Gene Louise Kelly, star of Uncle Buck and The Fantastics and Mr. Holland's Opus.
Oh, my God.
Mm-hmm.
We gotta go get a life.
I have a life.
It's a sad one,
but it's a life. and then the national tour also had Charlotte Ray.
Charlotte Ray
of Facts of Life fame
as Jack's mother.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about heartbreaking.
Oh my God.
I
to see her die.
Amazing. Ugh. Yeah.
And on Broadway, Felicia Rashad was the witch for a nice while. And she's in the Tony performance.
Nancy Dussault, Ellen Foley, who did the San Diego pre-Broadway production, mm-hmm. closed the show.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the national tour, Cleo Lane from Edwin Drood fame played the witch. I've seen videos of all these women playing the witch. And the crazy thing to me, they all bring their own little twist to mm-hmm. the witch, which I enjoy. It's just hard for me to get past their Bernadette Peters wig.
Absolutely.
Because they all have that big, curly Bernadette wig. It's mm-hmm. like, my God, I've got a better Bernadette wig than you.
Well, one of them, so I never realized with Bernadette that she had those, she has these things on the side of her head.
The little glittery pieces.
Yes, yeah, when she transforms. Yeah, she's got the little glittery pieces. I never noticed them because of her giant curly hair.
Right.
And it wasn't until I think I watched...
Well, those are the clips, you know.
So, but here's the thing. When I watched, I think it was Felicia Rashad do it on the Tonys, because her hair is like kind of slicked down a bit.
Yes.
That's when I noticed the clips, and I was like, has that always been there?
Well, yeah. Well, you watch the God. This is why it's called Obsessed.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at Bernadette's hair in Act Two, and you see the little glittery things.
Mm-hmm.
So in the transformation of Act One, her hair is not as big as it is in Act Two. So that is her hair. But then they have to put on that wig, and those clips clip in. Now, and they're a little more subtle. If you watch the PBS production,
mm-hmm.
for some reason I don't know where they went. But they, like for Felicia Rashad, they put these giant. It almost looks like a crown.
Yeah,
and
like giant wings.
And like. And Nancy Dussault has those, and Cleo Lane. They've got these. It's like this, and those. It's not subtle.
It's not
very subtle. It's very 80s.
It's very 80s.
Yeah.
It's like she's in a music video for Pat Benatar or something.
Honestly, I think the witches that honestly dates the show for me. Everything else I can kind of buy as kind of a timeless era, but when you see the witches
transformation outfit,
it's just a little like, oh, that. Now we're in the 1980s.
I'm the hitch. I'm what no one believes. I'm the witch. You're all liars and thieves, like his father, like his son will be too. Oh, why bother? You'll just do what you do, Estella.
Before we wrap things up, I do want to do a quick dissertation with you on the importance of the giant in Act Two of Into the Woods.
Sure.
So I wrote a piece about this for, there's an event that does these like Broadway TED Talks, and they were looking for submissions, and I submitted this and they said no.
Oh.
So I'm going to use this opportunity to talk about it.
Let's talk about it.
If you don't know the plot of Into the Woods, pause and find the plot and then come back, because we're not going to overly explain.
It's a long plot.
It's a long plot. There are many things. The giant that wreaks the havoc in Act 2.
Mm-hmm.
Every time Into the Woods comes back to us, it's a representation of whatever's happening in our society. So in the 80s, and I don't know necessarily if... I don't think Sondheim and James Lapine meant for it to reflect
right.
that.
Yeah, I know where you're going now.
But, you know, it being... art, it takes on a life of its own after a while.
Absolutely.
It goes beyond what the authors intended, and it takes on a new meaning. In the 80s, when Into the Woods came out, it was...
the height of the AIDS epidemic.
Yes, and was definitely a reflection of that, and that's how audiences interpreted it.
Yes.
And then when it came back in 2001, it very much felt like the aftermath of 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And then recently, it has felt like... the most recent election, just sort of this it's always,
it's heavy.
Yeah, Act Two very much is a reflection on a society in disarray and how people react in crisis.
Mm-hmm.
There are the people who plan, and there are the people who look for the good in things. There are the people who immediately look for the worst in things. There are the people who hide. There are the people who and just grasp at straws and say like whatever it takes to survive. And I think that every time Into the Woods comes back, it makes us sort of check in with ourselves of how we are dealing with the crisis in our society.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just want to get your take on that and sort of how you feel and what characters you think reflect what.
I think there's a statement out there where James Lapine or Stephen Sondheim have said the giant is not supposed to represent AIDS specifically.
Yes.
They did not write this show as a response to the AIDS epidemic.
Yes, they have said that. But here's the thing.
Here's the thing?
Yes.
Well, I mean...
I'm throwing it back at them with you.
I thought I read somewhere that it wasn't a direct response to that. I could be totally wrong here. So,
no, but
I think maybe the statement is that, yes, the AIDS epidemic happened. Yes, 9/11 happened. Yes, the 2016 election happened. But what it comes down to is the, beyond all that, it comes down to loss and moving on, mm-hmm. And coping, and how we cope, whether it is hiding or giving up, mm-hmm. Or fighting through. I think it is an emotional experience that we all experience differently, because that is what makes us human. We all make choices, and I think what they're trying to reiterate, no matter what, no one is alone. So you can interpret it as to be a representation of HIV and AIDS, mm-hmm. and you can interpret it to be the 2016 election and 9/11 and mm-hmm. all that. But take that away, the human condition experiences loss and hardships, and that's what fairy tales do for us. They help us, they teach us lessons, and that's what they wanted to do with this. That we're learning lessons how we can cope and deal and move on mm-hmm. in whatever way we do. I hope that's making sense.
No, it does. And I'm not saying that was their intention. They've openly said that it's not about AIDS, but it's interesting that when it comes back, each time it comes back, these things happen in our society that make it even more relevant. The emotions are what make people
connect
to it.
How we deal with it as a community.
Exactly.
And it gets hard because because we lived in such a digitized era, you know, people can go from 0 to 90 like that. Mm-hmm. So it's hard as a community to respond intelligently. And it's easy to respond emotionally. Are you going to respond like the stepmother and the siblings and run away? Are you going to respond like the witch and throw the beans away and disappear in a cloud of smoke? Mm-hmm. Are you going to respond like the baker and try to abandon everything but come to his senses and come back? You know,
are you going to be like the baker's wife and fight and try to find the good and the logic and everything? There's a story I was told in college, and I wish I remembered the actual names of these people. But it's how I feel about Into the Woods in regards to Sondheim and Lapine, which is, and art in general, but this specifically, because that's what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. There was some like very prolific science fiction writer who was asked to come to a university and give a lecture on his work. And he goes to do the lecture, blah, 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 and he's there for like 2 days. And on the second day, he finds out that there's actually a professor who teaches a course on his stuff.
Oh, interesting.
So he decides he's going to go, and he's going to sit in and like listen to this professor, because he's like, oh, this should be fun. So he goes to the class, sits in the back incognito. No one knows who he is. And the professor is talking about a book and talking about this passage and, you know, a lot of the meaning behind it. And the guy raises his hand. He goes, that's not what that passage is about. And the professor goes, why do you think that? And he goes, well, because I wrote it. I'm the dude. And then the professor looks at him dead in the face. He goes, what makes you think just because you wrote it, you know more about it than I do?
Oh, well.
Which is an interesting idea, because there, all you can say is what the intention was when you wrote it. But then right. Once it's out there,
once other people interpret it.
Yeah, because I mean,
but that's the beauty of theater, isn't it?
Yeah, well, and that's what I love about Into the Woods, and that's what I mean with Sondheim and Lapine and The Giant and how people interpret it as the AIDS crisis, and they had to say that's not what the meaning is. But it still meant that to a lot of people.
Right.
And I don't think when you're a writer or you're an artist, once you create it, it stops being yours.
Right.
You can give insight into the process and what it meant for you, but then it starts meaning different things to different people.
I think the danger with that is taking it too literally.
Sure.
You know, if you go off and you do a production of Into the Woods, like listening to your podcast the other day, and it's a refugee camp.
Oh yeah, that was fun.
And having the giant as a guard shooting the characters off, like that to me. Listen, I'm all for interpretation. Mm-hmm. That's great. I've heard there's one production of Into the Woods where it's modernized, and instead of, you know, the steward has a gun, and so instead of banging the Jack's mother, shoots her, and then drops the gun, and then the witch grabs the gun, hides it, and turning into the last midnight is instead, here you want a bean, bang. It becomes too extreme.
Yes.
You're starting to get away. You're not allowing the audience to come to their own judgment, their own interpretation, to their own, how do I take this story in?
I think that goes back, though, to when we were talking about actors watching the original video and then trying to go the exact extreme opposite of what they did to make their mark. Into the Woods is one of a few shows that is a trap for many directors where it's more about making their mark and showing right. off their intelligence.
And not just trusting the yeah. text and the music and the material.
There are so many opportunities for clever bits of staging and for, totally. and for ideas. But you do have to immediately start with, what is the show about? Who are these people? And what does this, you know, what are my immediate reactions to this? Don't try to impose stuff on the text. And that's not just Into the Woods, that's everything.
Exactly. The reason why, you know, Shakespeare comes mm-hmm. with just like enter mm-hmm. Banquo and we're in a bar, yada, yada, yada. The rest is up to you.
Absolutely.
You know, you get to connect the dots and fill in everything else. So yeah, if you're going to have Into the Woods and Refugee Camp, sure. I might not like it. Someone else might. But yeah. like, you're kind of getting away from it, aren't you?
Yeah, you're getting further away. And I think it is still important to talk to writers about intention, especially if you're having problems with something, if you're finding something problematic in like terms of its message. If you're like, this is what I'm getting from this character and I find it very upsetting, the authors can say like, great, that character's meant to be upsetting, like how do you deal with that? Or they can right. say, here's actually what this character's doing and it might make him or her less upsetting to you.
Yeah.
That is important. I do think, in especially in this day and age with the internet and people taking things literally sometimes or at face value,
yes.
we don't explore the gray area of a lot of characters. And so people go, well, this show is problematic or this character is problematic because X, Y, and Z. It's like, yes, they're not a perfect person and they have right. a lot of dark flaws, as do most people. And I think that's the beauty of Into the Woods, is the first act is all of their flaws are very shallow and lovely and we find them funny.
And it's something familiar. These yes. are stories that we all know and we have heard of.
Mm-hmm.
And then with act two, flipping the switch
mm-hmm.
and taking away the familiarity,
mm-hmm.
but also trying to push all these characters' buttons to kind of push the humanity out of them.
Mm-hmm. And seeing them at their rawest. Core, at their rawest, yeah. What they truly are and, you know, what they are willing to become. Before we close out,
yeah.
if you were to cast a production of Into the Woods, because you talk about how amazing you'd be as a casting director, who do you have?
I thought about this.
Have you?
Let me get my notes here for a second. Una momentita, por favor. Jefferson Mays. Are you familiar with Jefferson Mays?
Of course.
From Gentleman's Guide mm-hmm. to Love and Murder. And
I Am My Own Wife.
Yes. I think he'd be a genius as the narrator and mysterious man.
Absolutely.
I'm
down for that.
Here are a couple options for you for The Witch. I would love Audra McDonald
mm-hmm.
as The Witch, or Carolee Carmello, of course,
mm-hmm.
or Rachel York.
Ooh, Rachel York would be good.
Rachel York would be very good.
I like that a lot.
I kind of love the idea of Bonnie Milligan as Little Red. She would also be a really fierce witch as well.
She would be.
I also think Anne Harada would be amazing as the baker's wife.
She'd be a great baker's wife. Because
she's got that dryness that Joanna Gleason kind of has.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I need her to be Joanna Gleason, but the baker's wife, she's kind of ahead of the game a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
She is really the hero of Act One.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she is the reason, she is the force behind the baker. And I think Anne Harada could get that.
Oh, yeah.
Who would you cast?
I know that I would really love to see Norbert Leo Butz as the baker.
Oh, he'd be great.
I think he'd be great. The two women I keep coming back to for the baker's wife are Jessie Mueller and Katrina Lenk, which I find it ironic that they're the two names that keep rolling around for Bobby. I'm like, they're my two baker's wives.
I think Katrina Lenk would be great. I think Jessie
Mueller...
For
different reasons.
Yeah, for totally different reasons.
Jessie Mueller would be a little more of an emotional baker's wife, and yes. it would be... I think she would play it straight in terms of, like, the stakes mm-hmm. in Act One, which would be very funny. Katrina Lenk would have that dryness that Joanna Gleason has, and I think would maybe even be slightly sassier than Joanna Gleason in a, yeah. like a deadpan kind of
in
way.
In her own way.
Yes.
I think that not sarcastic, but that dryness is necessary for that role.
Absolutely.
She's a woman who puts up with a lot. Mm-hmm. And so that dryness gets her through.
Absolutely. You know, and I would love to see either one of them. Maybe they can flip-flop. I would be down for Philippa Sue as Cinderella.
Oh, yeah, that's a good cast.
She would
right there,
sing
yeah.
the shit out of it. Renee Elise Goldsberry as the witch, I think, would be ferocious.
Uh-huh.
She's Angelica in Hamilton.
Yes. I would love to see... I think Lauren Molina would be fantastic as Rapunzel. Lauren Molina from the Skivvies.
Yes, Lauren Molina from Sweeney Todd and the Skivvies. Yes, she'd be a great Rapunzel.
Mm-hmm. Nick Seeley would be a great Jack. Oh, that kid from Stranger Things was really good as Jack, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
He was really fantastic.
He looked like he was good. I only saw a little clip, but he looked good. I would like some, you know, fresh faces for Little Red and Jack. Cindy Lucas, maybe.
I don't
maybe.
Want a kid. Like, they cast those kids in the revival, and I hated them.
No. they're tricky roles.
I hated them.
They're tricky roles, because I don't want them to be children.
No.
And adults are fine. I really like the idea of them being at, like, 16, 17, in the sense that they have that innocence, but it's also that transition period that a lot of Disney characters are in the Disney Renaissance films, where, like, they're no longer children, but they're not quite mature enough to be adults yet. And they're in that
right.
passage of time where, like, they're aware of their surroundings, they're aware of who they are and what they want, or at least in their sheltered universe of what they want and who they are. And it's the moment where the shit hits the fan and they really have to kind of figure out...
They have to become adults real fast.
Yeah, real fast. And deal with a lot of stuff that they weren't prepared to deal with.
Yeah.
Be careful what you wish for.
Okay.
Careful the things you say.
Let me ask you a question.
Yes.
So, who would you be more excited to hear as the voice of the giantess? Julie Andrews, Glenn Close, Whoopi Goldberg, Judi Dench.
Well, I've heard Glenn Close do it in the Central Park
once.
And I think she would be a really good giantess. What I didn't like about that revival with her giantess was that it was a very, like, dark, menacing giantess, but spoken very slowly.
Yes.
What I liked about Merle Louise in the original was
it's human.
The human and the stakes. There was passion behind it. There was energy. There was pacing to it. I've often found with the giantess, people play that scene way too slowly. I'm like, there's a goddamn 30-foot giant in front of you, and she's shaking with anger.
I will say Whoopi Goldberg was... Her voice work as the giantess at the Hollywood Bowl was really... It was frightening and really, like... good.
I would like to listen to that. I'm sure she'd be great. I would love to hear Bernadette Peters do it.
Would be fascinating.
I think she would really kind of bring some gravitas to that. Shits and giggles, Patti LuPone. Patti LuPone would get those people off their asses.
That's become like a staple now, like for, you know, established royal actresses that to play
Judi
that
Dench
voice.
Would fucking kill it too.
I think Angela Lansbury did it when they did it in DC, I think. She'd be good doing that though, too.
I haven't heard her be like angry since her Manchurian Candidate days. ever since Mame, she's like, I'm your grandma.
You need to go watch the Harvey Girls. She plays a madam of a burlesque house and she's the villain and she's awesome.
I mean, Angela Lansbury used to be the vixen and all vixens. Speaking of Angela Lansbury, I'm coming back around. Angela Lansbury, Mame. You know who I'd love to see play the witch in A Return to the Stage?
Megan Mullally?
Toni Collette.
Ooh!
Toni fucking Collette.
Yeah.
Bring
Toni Collette back to Broadway.
That's the rumor is Mame 2021.
Really?
Yes, which I'm not mad about.
No, not either. I would prefer Megan Mullally as Mame. I think Megan Mullally as Mame is a...
Megan Mullally as Mame. You know what would be great? Toni Collette as Mame, Megan Mullally as Vera.
Done. Sold. Done. Produce it. Let's give it
to me in every orifice that I have.
If you were to direct a production of Into the Woods, how would you direct it?
I would direct it with a turntable.
Mm-hmm.
I love a good turntable. I think turntables bring a nice sense of movement. I would also have it sparsely designed. I don't want a big, like, open space with, like, lights everywhere. I like the idea of Phantom, where it's this big black box and things kind of come out of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, one thing can represent a whole bunch of shit. And the idea that anything can come from anywhere.
Interesting.
That's what I like about the Phantom design. And that's what I would want to bring to the woods. So it's this sense of magic and mystery, but also a slight sense of danger.
Mm-hmm.
And then turn that on its head in Act 2, where, you know, eventually by the end of the show... Once the giant is killed, we do finally have some light on the stage. There is light everywhere, and you see the vat, and you sort of see the wreckage that it's caused. Because until then, it's sort of this sense of wonder, and anything can happen, and the stage is so full, as far as we're aware. And then by the end of the show, the lights are brighter, and you see the vast empty space that they now have to build a new world out of.
Yeah, I like that.
Thank you. What about you? How would you do it?
I think I would like to direct it kind of as, because I feel so strongly that it's really a Shakespearean styled piece, mm-hmm. I would probably try to direct it as a as an old-fashioned Old Globe style mm-hmm. production with just like, because those Old Globe productions back in the day, mm-hmm. there was the balcony, there were the doors, and that was it. And mm-hmm. then some set pieces. So very minimalistic. I'd probably have the very small band off in the corner and have them dressed up in Renaissance style period mm-hmm. piece costumes as well. I just think that kind of establishes the heightened state, kind of brings it back to a classic sense of theatricality that I think it deserves. Mm-hmm. I think the spectacle and the magic that it requires, like the witch disappearing and the transformation and mm-hmm. seeing the beanstalk rise and the giant's feet, like that requires a sense of suspending your own disbelief because the actors are creating the magic. I mm-hmm. think I like that.
I like that too. If I were to do that, I would actually make it so that way they are in the audience. It's all over the place. But as the play continues, especially in Act Two, the amount of space they take up gets smaller and smaller. So by the end of the show, they're like basically in the main stage area and they don't leave it by the end.
Right.
Just see how much smaller the world gets.
Exactly. And I would want it to start, because with Old Globe productions, they mm-hmm. always performed, it was always matinees. Mm-hmm. But so I would start the show at like 5:30 around sunset. So by Act One is, you know,
in daylight,
lit by the day. And then by Act Two, it gets darker and darker and darker.
So the reverse of my original production.
Exactly.
I love it. I love it. There's room for all the woodses.
Mm.
plenty of wood to share.
Oh, good night, everybody.
Good night.
Enough about my sex life.
Mm-hmm.
my sex life is into the woods.
It's, I mean, that, what a great porno.
Ooh. Gee, oh, my God. Gotta go.
Into the woods, more like the woods are into me.
Good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody. All right. Prescott Sutton,
yes.
Lee, where can people find you on the meads?
On the socials, you can find me on Instagram at Sutton Lee Seymour. Mm-hmm. I just tell people look for Sutton Foster and the drag queen underneath her.
Always.
Find me on Facebook at Sutton Lee Seymour. On Twitter, I'm at the Sutton Lee, because Twitter has weird letter allowances and I can't fit the R. So anyway, but I'm barely on Twitter. So come to Instagram. I'm so close to almost 10,000 followers, and I need that for the frickin' swipe up for tickets thing.
Yeah.
But come see me at Broadway Mondays at Hardware Bar with Cacophony Daniels and Paige Turner. Mm-hmm. And then if you live in Astoria, which I do a weekly show at Albatross Bar.
Beautiful. You can find me on Instagram too, at Matt Koplik. I am less than a tenth away from 10,000 followers. I think I have less than 800, but then again, I don't use Instagram very often, so if you do follow me, joke's on you. Sutton, who would you like to play us out today?
Have we done Joanna Gleason yet?
We have not.
Done. I mean, it seems appropriate.
I mean, just to fuck with you, I'm going to play her in Nick and Nora.
No.
No, I won't.
Don't do that to me.
I love her too much.
I know.
I know.
I met her once. And she was the most lovely woman in the world.
Oh, I bet.
I was working at Pearl Studios at the time. I got to check her in, and you're not supposed to say, I love you, but I just had to say thank you for your performance in Into the Woods. It inspired me to pursue a life in the theater, and I just had to say thank you.
And she said, you're gay, aren't you?
And she said that, yes. No, she just said thank you. She said, that's really nice to hear. And I told her, I said, you probably hear that a lot. And she said, I don't actually. So if you ever meet Joanna Gleason, be sure you thank her for her wonderful performance in Into the Woods.
I was with my dad a few weeks ago, and he said, Matt, who's the actress who plays Woody Allen's wife in Crimes and Misdemeanors? And I said, Joanna Gleason? He goes, yeah, that's who. And I went, first of all, Dad, she's not known as Woody Allen's wife in Crimes and Misdemeanors. She's known as the Tony Award-winning, iconic, original Baker's wife, and I'm embarrassed for you for not knowing that. And he apologized, and I said, yeah, you're forgiven, but just always know. Always know. She's not Joanna Gleason from The Wedding Planner.
She's Joanna Gleason from Into the Woods.
And always will be.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Joanna. Thank you, Prescott Sutton Lee.
Oh my God, thank you, Matt.
I'm just going to call you Prescott Sutton Lee forever.
A lot of people call me Prescott Lee.
Prescott Lee?
Yeah, Prescott. Yeah, it's weird. Yeah.
He walked down the street, Prescottly.
I'm a verb now.
You are a verb.
Fuck you very much.
And fuck you too. Bye, everybody.
Why not fall instead? There's the answer if you're clever. Have a child for warmth and a baker. bread and a prince for whatever. Never, it's these woods. Face the facts, find the boy, join the group, stop the giant, just get out of these woods. Was that him? Yes, it was. Was that me? No, it wasn't just a trick of the woods. Just a moment, one peculiar passing moment.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.